This will be the start of the homoptera then. Again, the homoptera, in your older versions of the textbook, this was a whole separate order. We've all been over that a number of times. This has now been rolled in with the hemiptera. So there is no homoptera anymore. Essentially now we, in this, what used to be the old homoptera, it's still kind of a group that's convenient to look at. Again, we talked about some differences between it and the heteroptera. The wings tend to be more uniform in texture. We don't have this distinct half and half texture that goes on in the heteroptera. Also, the beak seems to arise more towards the posterior part of the head, not up at the anterior part like we saw in the heteroptera. And in general, these things hold their wings more roof-like over their back, where, again, with some exceptions, but most of the heteroptera holds their wings more flat over their backs. In the homoptera, we kind of, again, I've had put this up on the whiteboard a while back, but we kind of recognize three suborders within in this group. There was the Coleorhynchia, which we really don't cover. I'll just mention and show you pictures. But it's a group that doesn't have very many species. It's a small group that's mainly down in southern South America, in Australia, New Zealand, and down in there. We'll talk more about it, but it's kind of a connecting link between the old homoptera. They think it's really an ancient primitive group, so related to the ancestors to this whole complex. And then there's two suborders that are much more common that we will be spending time with. The Acanorhynchia, which are things like cicadas and leafhoppers and membracids. And then there's the Sternorhynchia, which are more of the things like aphids and scales and whiteflies and things like that. These still go through this kind of gradual metamorphosis, although we'll see when we get to like the scales and things like that, that it gets a little bit more complicated, and there's actually some stages that now look almost like pupae or resting stage. The last nymphal instar will be more of a resting stage, kind of almost resembling a pupa. So we'll start to see the verge of, or maybe some hints at the of the holometabolist type metamorphosis. Like we did in the heteroptera, I'll maybe mention a few characters to be on the lookout for, not as much as we did. But in this group, for starting again with the head, the Acanorhynchia tend to have very small, short, hair-like antennae. So on this first handout on the homoptera, you can see over the left-hand side, see how the antennae are just kind of more hair-like. Here on these pictures in the middle, you can see just more hair-like. Whereas in the Sternorhynchia, the antennae are more like you would expect. Can be just a couple segmented up to like six or seven segments, but they're more filiform and more conspicuous. Again, once we get to things like scales and stuff, you won't even be able to see any antennae. But generally speaking, again, there you can see up at the top of this handout, the very top, there's a Acanorhynchia antenna. It looks more long and hair-like. And then the Sternorhynchia on the right-hand side there. Also, the placement of the antennae can differ. In the Acanorhynchia, certain groups, for example, the cicadas and that, the antennae, there's, well, maybe I should do it the other way. In more like the plant hoppers, there's a ridge on the front of the head. And you can't see it very well from the side, but what it does, it separates the antenna from the front of the head, and it makes it look like the antenna is actually coming off the head below the eyes. So on this first handout, that top middle figure of the head from the side, you can see the antenna coming off, and it looks like it's below the eyes. Whereas in things like the cicadas and membracids and that, there's not a ridge right there, and it appears that the antenna comes off the head more in front of the eyes. So, again, at least right here, we'll point it out more as when we get to those families, but right now, just be aware that the placement of the antennae may be important, whether it's separated from the front of the head by a ridge and whether it looks like it's coming from below the eye or from in front of the eyes. Compound eyes are usually well developed. Ocelli may or may not be present. If they're present, they may be two or three in number. Sometimes they'll be two, sometimes they'll be three. We'll deal with wing venation a little bit, but it's not as difficult as in some groups. They'll talk about a tegula. I don't know, did we talk about a tegula in earlier family? Anyway, a tegula is, really don't have a picture of it here, but it'd be a little scale-like flap that covers the base of the wing, if it has one. Some families have a tegula and some don't. Orientation of the wing, you kind of got to keep this straight. Remember, the costal margin is the more, when the wings are spread out, it's the more anterior. But most of these things you'll be looking at are in resting position. So where would the costal area be in resting position? Just look at this left hand. If this edge up here is the costal margin, over here it's in resting position. Just picture those wings folding up. Actually, the costal margin would be what's more downward or ventral. Whereas the anal margin is more posterior, would actually be this up here towards the middle. Sometimes it can be confusing, but the costal, the leading edge, would be downward in resting position. The back or posterior margin would be upwards. So again, yeah. Costal area just behind the anterior margin will be down in the Homoptera. Anal area will be up in Homoptera. We'll talk about a Y vein in the front wings. And again, I noticed later there's some figures that really show where it is. But what it is would be in the front anal area. So we're talking about this area right here, the anal part of it. And there'll actually be two veins coming out, and they come together and join, and only one goes out. So it forms a Y. And some families have that and some don't. So we'll be looking for a Y vein in some. And again, some of the later handouts show that Y vein very clearly. Again, I went through these now that I'm thinking about it, and I don't remember us talking about a stigma, but my notes say, again, may need to know what a stigma is. Just like in the odonates, it'd be a little bit thickened or area out on that leading edge out near the tip. An RS vein, sometimes we'll talk about. That's where the R vein, the radial vein, will come out. And it's really not labeled on this handout either, but it's where if there's an R vein and then a posterior branch of the R vein, that posterior one is called an RS or a radial sector vein. So it's where the radial, you'll see a nice anterior branch going way out, and then from fairly near the base, there'll be another branch of it going down and then out, and that's the RS vein. So radial sector, posterior of two main branches of the radius. Medial vein, of course, is that's between the radius and the cubitus. We'll be talking about the medial vein a little bit in the aphids. Pronotum, sometimes the shape of the pronotum will be important, especially things like the membracidae that really have amazingly expanded pronotum. Legs. Sometimes the number of tarsal segments will be important. We'll also, for certain families, we'll be looking. There's one family, in fact, the Delphaceti, that has this huge spur at the apex of the tibia. So it'll be a big spur. We'll be looking for that. That's this first handout, there's legs down at the bottom. The middle one has a big spur at the apex of the tibia. We'll be looking at the legs and whether they have one or two rows of spines along the tibia. That's how we recognize the cicadality from some of the other families. Also, when we get to the superfamily Fulgoroidea, we can split those families into two groups by the condition of the second tarsal segment. So you'll have to, this here is the very bottom right-hand figure. This long piece is the tibia, and then there's segment one, segment two, and segment three. That second segment can come in two forms. It can come down, and the apex will be kind of rounded, and there'll be a spine on each side. And then the next tarsal segment goes on down. And then there's some where that second tarsal segment comes down and it's squared off, not rounded, and there'll be a row of spines there. And then the next tarsal segment comes on down. And that's a nice way to break the, like I said, the Fulgoroidea up into a couple different groups. So again, just be aware, we'll be looking at the shape and the spines on the second tarsal segment of some families. I'll just mention the cornicles. In aphids, we'll be looking at that. I think you're familiar with the cornicles are, but it's those little tube-like structures coming out of the posterior end of some aphids.
The tailpipes. Yeah.
Are aphids the only families that have cornicles?
Pardon?
Are aphids the only ones that have cornicles?
As far as I know, yes. But there's several different aphid families. And the main one, the Aphididae, they usually do have cornicles. Some of the others, like the Areosomatids, sometimes do and sometimes don't. And then the other aphid families usually don't. So okay, that's the brief introduction. Now let's start rolling through some of this a little bit. First one, again, it's not required, but it's an important connecting link that I've been talking about several times. This is that superfamily, the Coleorhynchia. There's only the one family, the Perlor deity. Let's see, my notes, I know I had the numbers in here. 10 genera and 20 species are known from Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania, and South America. Again, it's thought to be a primitive group, and it's also the one that's kind of in between the Hemiptera and the Homoptera, kind of the connecting link between the two. It's interesting in that it does have, on the pronotum, kind of expanded out here. They call this Paranota. I think I mentioned it earlier. Which other family has Paranota? In the Heteroptera.
Oh, in the Heteroptera.
What group does Alex work on?
No.
Got him thinking. What'd you say?
I said Gordae.
No. What about the lace bugs? The Tingids have. They have the pronotum expanded out there like that in a lot of species, maybe not all of them, but they same thing there, they call it Paranota.
So
there's some that Kukulovapek and that thought
that's how, well, one of her hypotheses on how wings developed in insects was that the early ones had paranoia that became expanded more and more until, like squirrels, they could glide for a while, and then, I mean, not like squirrels, but the flying squirrels, but may eventually become wings. I don't know if that's very well accepted anymore or not, but anyway, not required. We do have some, again, I've talked about Alan Ashworth, who you're going to meet in that, but he collected some of these and gave them to us from South America. So now, moving into the groups that we do know, we'll start with the superfamily Acanarinca. These are the ones that have the more hair-like antennae. Let's see, Acanarinca. So antennae, what I like to do, is now I'm talking about this whole suborder, the Acanarinca antennae hair-like. Beak from back of head. So the beak appears to arise from the posterior part of the head.
When you look at it from the front, it doesn't exactly look like it does.
Yeah, it's hard to see from the front, sorry.
Yeah. Let's see. So Acanarinca, antennae very short and bristle-like, tarsi are usually three-segmented, beak arising from back of head. Males of some species can stridulate. These are usually fairly active insects. We've seen tree hoppers and leaf hoppers and cicadas and things, and they can, a lot of them can jump, but they're usually fairly active moving insects. Whereas when we get to the Sternarinca, we're talking about aphids and scales and whiteflies, and they tend to be much slower and more sedentary. Now, in the Acanarinca, we'll look at two superfamilies. And the first one is the Cicadoidea. So the Cicadoidea, characters that go with it is the tegula is absent. There's no Y vein. And the antennae are not separated from the front head by a carina. So the antennae look like they're coming out in front of eyes. I'll just put on there antennae anterior to eyes. As we'll see, the next one is the Fulgaroidea. It differs in these three characters. So now, the Cicadoidea, tegula usually absent, no Y vein in the front anal area of the front wing, antennae not separated from front of head by vertical carina, thus arising on front of head between eyes. First family we will look at is the Cicadidae, commonly called the cicadas. Easy, common name to remember, family name to remember. Mm-hmm. These are, tend to be relatively large, just based on that, and you can probably identify them just by their size, although down in the tropics there's some really tiny ones again. But again, large wings, the wings tend to be more membranous throughout. They have three ocelli. Figure right in the middle at the top, you can see those arrows, that's where the ocelli are. And there you can see the antennae, and that same figure coming out, looks like it's between the eyes, not below the eyes. In this group, the hind legs are not modified for jumping, so these don't really jump. They're very active flyers, though. But they're not modified for jumping like we'll see in the next couple families. They're sometimes commonly called locusts, but locusts generally are more applicable to the grasshoppers than that. These can produce sound. Actually, I think the next handout has some pictures of the sound-producing organs.
Venom and operculum.
Pardon?
Yeah.
They have a temple area. Temple area. You can see these kind of flaps that vibrate to cause that noise. Then right around it or below it is a huge air sac inside. So the timbal produces the noise, but there's this large air sac that's kind of like a resonating chamber that amplifies the noise and makes it really loud like we hear it. And then there's below that you can see the tympanum there. The tympanum is more of a hearing device, picks up vibrations. The noise that they produce, they can produce different kinds. There's an alarm sound sometimes they'll produce, but most of the time it's to help find a mate. And so each species will have a distinctive sound that they make. Some of them can be incredible. I forget if we still had it. Jerry used to have a recording. I think, I don't know where he got it off the internet or something, of a species in the Philippines, and it sounds like an air raid siren going off. You hear that and say, oh, there's incoming. You're about to get bombed, you know.
Do both males and females make noise?
Let's see.
I think that's dependent on the species, or on the species that's there. Because I know that, no.
And see, I read through these notes and I thought it said something about males produce loud sound. In my notes it just says males produce loud sound. Sound is characteristic for the species. Also makes different sounds for courting and for alarm. Sounds are produced by a pair of timbals located at the sides of the base of the abdomen. Sound is amplified by this resonating chamber, which is a large air sac. Both sexes possess tympana, so typically the males produce the sound, but both males and females have the hearing structure, the tympana. These deposit their eggs by inserting them in twigs and branches of trees. And up here, we don't see lots of cicadas, so it's not a big problem. But in some parts of the U.S. or some places, you can have huge emergences. I mean, literally hundreds and thousands of specimens. And when you've got that many inserting their eggs, you can have quite a bit of damage to the trees that weakens them, and they break and fall to the ground. Again, here, when I first came here, we almost didn't have any cicadas. I mean, it was a big deal when we catch one. I remember the house I live in now, I think we moved in there around 2000. The first year or two, I was painting the house, and one flew up and landed on my ladder while I was painting, and I caught it. And we kind of made a big deal about it. Now, when I go for a walk in late summer, I mean, about every quarter mile, you hear another one and stuff. So they seem to have gotten much more common up here. There are two different kinds of cicadas that we talk about, at least in North America. There's what we call the annual or dog day cicadas. And in any given area, they're out annually every year. They have, the life cycle is like 4 years long, though, but they still, you have individuals every year. Then there's another group that are called periodical cicadas. and they have much longer life cycles. There's kind of like six species, typically. They're in pairs. There's three that species that have 13-year life cycles and three that have 17-year life cycles. And they tend to be well synchronized. So you only get a big emergence every 13 years or every 17 years. And there's kind of different broods of those different species too. But they've got it. You probably can go on the internet and find a map. They'll have a map and they'll plot it out. What part of the country's expecting to hatch out of cicadas any given year. It's interesting, the ones that we see every year, like we have up here, the annual or dog day cicadas, they tend to be darker in color, kind of blackish, with green markings on them, little hints of green, and the wing venation will be kind of greenish. Whereas the periodical cicadas, they're paler in color, and like the eyes and the wing venation tend to be more orange or reddish in color. So what I've also heard is, like ours, when you only have a few here and there, they're very shy and skittish. You know, if you hear one in a tree and you think you can get there, it'll probably fly before you get anywhere near it. You know, they just take off, and so they're hard to catch. But in these huge outbreaks, they say they become very docile. When you've got hundreds and thousands of them, you can just walk up and pick them off the branches and stuff. And so they do lay their eggs in the twigs or branches. The immatures hatch out and drop to the ground, where they then go underground and feed on the roots of various plants and that. And like I said, ours will be underground for 4 years, and then the others will be underground for 13 or 17 years. So I guess I could mention the dog day. The common name dog day cicadas just refers because they tend to see them or hear them more in the latter half of the summer, when it becomes harvest time and in the dog days of summer. So anyway, that's the cicadas. Now, the next family we'll take a look at is the Membraceae. Still in the Cicadoidea, so it has the characters we talked about. No tegula, no Y-vein, the antennae coming off more or less between the eyes. In this family, the pronotum is usually much enlarged and expanded. It extends back over the back, covers the abdomen to a large extent. And most of our species, the pronotum, I mean, it's enlarged, but they kind of look more like thorns or spines or enlargements on the side of a tree or stem. Whereas in the tropics, they get really bizarre looking. You know, there's some examples on this first handout and on your next handout too that show some of the bizarre transformations, the pronotum, how it can be expanded in that. I may have some examples that I can bring in too from some that I collected down in the tropics. These only have two ocelli. Remember, the cicadidae had three. Here, the hind legs are modified for jumping. You probably had, again, we caught some on our field trips out there, and if you went to go catch them, pick them out of your net, they probably jumped from you or tried to jump from you some. Again, the pronotum broadly expanded. Some are shaped like thorns. The beak's not very long, not extending to the hind coccy. These are all plant feeders. Many will come to lights. These also lay their eggs by inserting them into plant stems. And so most of the species, that's if they cause damage, that's how they do it. There is some that will cause damage from their feeding. There's one, what's it called? The three-cornered alfalfa hopper gets on a stem of alfalfa and will insert its beak in and feed for a little while, and then it'll pull its beak out and then just go around the stem a little bit and do it all again, and keeps doing that until it goes all the way around the stem and actually kind of girdles the plant, will cause damage and girdling all the way around the base of the plant. And it's usually they are down towards the bottom of it, so it ends up killing the whole plant. There's another species called the buffalo tree hopper that's more of a pest on apples and other trees like that. A lot of these species exude honeydew. Without going into a lot of detail, a lot of the Homoptera groups feed on plant sap. And plant sap has a lot of water in it with low amounts of nutrients in it. So a lot of it's just water. And so they've evolved a specialized digestive system called a filter chamber. Again, we get into this in much more detail in morphology. Right, Dylan?
Mm-hmm.
But a filter chamber, it's actually a digestive system that comes down and it loops back on itself and comes in contact with itself. And what happens is the water, liquid part of it, can diffuse through that connection and goes right on out. And the nutrients, the sugars and stuff that are important for the insect, then go through the rest of the digestive system and is digested normally. But it's a specialized digestive system that allows it to shunt those liquids out away from the nutrients, and then it just keeps the nutrients in. But in doing so, then they exude lots of liquid from the anus that still has traces of sugars in it, and that's what they call honeydew. And that's what ants really like. And so you'll see ants, you know, a lot of times at aphids and stuff, but this is another group, the membracids. Ants will tend...
actually kind of treat somewhat like cattle, in a sense.
They'll stand around and guard them and drink the honeydew. And even in some cases, they'll take the immatures and take them down in their colonies and put them in the inside their ant nest and put them on roots down there. And so they'll actually, these immature membracids will live inside the ant colonies. I mean, they don't go down there on their own, I don't think. It's the ants that cart them down there and protect them. So
that's where you got that scene from the movie Ants.
Oh, yeah. So, okay, next family. There might have been something else I should have said. Yeah, the Cercopidae. Oh, there's still another handout of the membracids. Again, to show you some of the weird extensions. Some of these, the second handout, those clear over to the right-hand side. Sometimes marked with blacks and yellows. But if you, you know, and the membrane's clear, so if you look at that real quick, it kind of looks like an ant or a wasp. Mm-hmm. And even in the tropics, they fly a wasp would, buzzing a little bit and stuff. And so they're really kind of neat looking. But anyway, the next family is the Cercopidae, which are commonly called frog hoppers or spittle bugs. Called frog hoppers because, I mean, they do have hind legs for jumping, so they can jump. They look a little, especially the squat ones, more shorter, robust ones, look a little bit like a frog, maybe. They're called, another common name is the, oops.
Yeah, I think
you're looking at it
one.
And it dropped off, huh?
Oh, boy.
The spittle bugs come from that common name is that the immatures actually do exude some chemicals out of the anus and some glands on the 7th and 8th abdominal segments, kind of a mucilaginous substance. And then they have an air channel going from their spiracles up on the thorax and kind of pump air down this channel into this mucilaginous substance, and it forms like what looks like a massive spit around them. And of course, we can get a little anthropogenic on it. It is for protection, but if you were a predator, would you want to eat something that seems to be covered with spit or spittle? So, anyway, the cercopids, they're relatively small, kind of brownish or blackish in color, although there are a couple that are very differently marked. Down in the southern U.S., there's some that have got black and red bands across them. And what you're likely to confuse these with is the next family, the Cicadellidae, the leaf hoppers. But this group, there may be some spines down at the apex of the tibia, but along the margins, they'll only have at most one or two spines along the margin of the tibia. Can't see them very well on this handout. This one from underneath, you can kind of see that there's one or two spines there too. So, but along the tibia, there's along the margin, again, there may be some down at the apex, but along the length of the tibia, there's only a couple, one or two or three stout spines. These also have two ocelli. Again, you shouldn't confuse them with the membracids. The pronotum's not enlarged like you saw in the membracids. Again, hind tibia with one or two stout spines. There may be a few more spines at the apex of the tibia. Again, the hind legs are modified for jumping. These feed on trees, shrubs, or herbaceous plants. I already talked about the spittle, how it's produced. Again, some of these may exude honeydew. There's one species on our prairies here, Phalaenus spumarius, may cause damage on clover. Some in the south cause damage to pine trees. So, but they're fairly common around here. There's a good chance you guys have some spittle bugs. May not even know it.
I know I have that one.
Oh, the one.
Parrot.
Found it there.
Yeah.
And then the last family we'll talk about in the Cicadoidea is the Cicadellidae. And these are the leaf hoppers. You could kind of see some similarities with this family and the Myridae. You know, the Myridae is a large family with lots of species on all different kinds of plants. That's what this is. In the Homopteran part, this is a large family with lots and lots of species. And again, they tend to be somewhat host specific in that. These look a lot like the Cercopidae, but now look at the tibia, especially the hind tibia. They have those one or two rows of spines up and down the length of the tibia. It's very characteristic when you look at them. So, relatively small, 2 to 13 millimeters. There's a lot of brown and brownish and greenish ones, but there's some that also have some really beautiful coloration to them, different stripes and things. They have two or less ocelli. Again, their hind legs are modified for jumping, so they'll jump and hard to catch sometimes. We catch tons of these out on the prairies, and actually there was a guy in Canada by the name of Hamilton who worked on cicadellids, and he actually sent us, it was just a handwritten key that he had developed for the prairie obligate species, or species that you'd normally find in prairies. And that didn't include all the species in our area, because there's things in town and different places and up on the trees and that, but this was mainly the prairies. And it actually worked pretty good. I spent a fair amount of time identifying a lot of our cicadellids that we were getting in some of our prairie projects. Thing was that you could identify most of the species, but then there was a couple genera that were all little tiny brown ones, and another genus that were all little tiny green ones. And those were almost impossible. So I had all of these cicadellids identified, and then I had a drawer that just said small brown ones, and another one said small green ones. And That's where I ended with it. You can draw on all different kinds of plants. Some of these can vector some diseases, so they can be economic pests. In this family, there's a lot of subfamilies, which some workers have raised to family level, but most, I think, we still just consider them all subfamilies of this family. There's a few of these that can also, similar to the cicadas, can generate sound. They may have the timbres, but they're usually frequencies that or they're not loud enough. They don't have the resonating chambers that we can't hear them. Normally, where people don't hear them anyway, making sound. So adults of some species stridulate via timbres similar to cicadas, but the sounds are usually inaudible to humans. Now we go into the, well, there's another handout showing you some of the diversity of cicadality. You can see some with very unusual color patterns. That next handout, the lower right hand corner, you can see some have long prolonged heads and stuff. They're typically out on the grasses. We do get some of those with those long head out on our prairies around here. So, but now, like I said, we now move into the other super family, the Fulgaroidea. As a group, these are commonly called plant hoppers. Here, now we're talking about the Fulgaroidea, and now they usually, tegula is present. Typically these now have that Y vein present. And what we're talking about right here, you can see that middle one here, and you can see that vein coming out and this vein coming out, and they meet, and just a single one continues on out towards the apex of the wing, and so it kind of forms that Y. The tegula, again, I think this is what, and then the center bottom, you can see it's that little squarish area right at the base of the wing. That would be the tegula. And then this group, now there's often a carina or ridge that separates the antenna from the front of the head. And so now antenna, I'll just say antenna below. But you can see the side figure here at the top of this first one, how now the antenna appears to come out below the eyes. So in the Fulgaroidea, tegula present, Y vein present, and the antennae appears to come off the head below the eyes. Now, as I said in the intro, is this group, we can divide the families in this superfamily into two groups by the structure of the second tarsal segment. And in the families of the Fulgaroidea can be placed into one of two groups based upon the structure of the hind tarsi. In these first ones, the Delphacidae, Derbidae, Cyxeidae, Dictyopharidae, Fulgaroidae, and Achillidae, the hind tarsus, the second segment, has this row of apical spines. And so right here you can see this picture in the middle, this would be the tibia right here. This is segment one, there's two, and there's three. And what we're looking at is the apex of this second segment is kind of squared off, and there's a row of spines. Okay? Whereas when we get later on, two or three of the later families, this will be different. It'll come down and be more rounded, and there'll just be a spine
on each side.
On each side. Now, one hint is before I would even look at that, if you know you've got a Fulgaroidea, this family you can identify without having to look at that tarsal character. This family is very characteristic in that it has this big spur at the apex of the tibia. So that's what this figure's really showing, is you see this big spur. You see it on all these figures. There's a spur. And none of the other families have that. So if you got a Homoptera, I mean, none of the Cicadoidea have it either. So if you got a Homoptera, take a look at it, and if you see a big spur coming off the apex of the hind tibia, you know you've got Delphacidae. This is the largest, more common family of the Fulgaroidea. Again, hind tibia with this large flattened spur. It is movable. Again, the second segment of the hind tarsi has that row of spines. These sometimes are dimorphic, meaning that there'll be long-winged forms and short-winged forms. Most of these feed on grasses or sedges, the Poaceae or the Cyperaceae. A few can vector diseases. There was one that used to be on, really threatened the Hawaiian sugarcane industry. There was a major pest on sugarcane a good while back. But I like Delphacids. They're around here. There's, again, a good chance that you may have caught some of those in your samples. So the next family I'll mention is the Derbidae. Just like to say the Derbidae. The Derbidae, they don't have that spur, of course. The couple things that are characterized these, they tend to have really long, slender wings. So look how much longer the wings look are in some of these species than the body. They go way beyond the apex of the body. The main character is that the beak, the last segment of the beak, is rather short and kind of chopped off at the end, it looks like, or what we'd call truncate. But you can see that picture in the middle there, this handout, how that last segment of the beak is relatively short and truncate or squared off somewhat at the apex. Also, there's a tendency for the antennae to be kind of bent and branched. So you can see a lot of these examples, but the antennae just look kind of weird, bent or almost look mangled, and sometimes there'll be several branches to the antennae. Small, delicate, moth-like insects, usually with elongate, long wings. More common in the tropics, but we do have several species here. One of the first ones I ever collected was right there by the main building at the Moorhead Science Center. Going down that little gravel road on the side of it there, I caught one on a tree there. But then another, just a couple years ago, one of the South Fargo sites that I showed you, I caught like maybe a half a dozen, which is really weird. Usually you only catch one here or one there, but I caught at least three or four anyway, all in one time down at one of those sites. So they are around here. They're really kind of cool. They're, again, not fast moving, fast flyers or anything. They're much slower. Terminal segment of the beak short, not more than 1.5 times as long as wide. Again, the second segment of the hind tarsi with the row of spines. My notes say they feed on woody fungi, so they may be on the fungi on the trees and stuff. But the next family we'll talk about is the Cyxeidae. six Zeti. These also lack the spur at the apex of the tibia, so you shouldn't confuse them with the Delphacids. Their last beak segments is longer. It's not like we saw in the Derbidae. The wings aren't usually near as elongate as you see in the Derbidae. So the front of the head may or may not be prolonged out in front. You can see the lower, the second one on the bottom row from the left, the head's kind of produced out in front of the eyes. But generally speaking, they're not, but a few maybe. You'll see why that's important here in a minute, too. Second segment of the tarsi still has the row of terminal spines. Now, the frons is either without a carina, so this front part of the head, there in this family, there's either no carinae or there may be one carina right down the middle. And if there's one right down the middle, there's usually often just one ocellus kind of at the juncture of that carina and where the clypeus would start. So fronds either without carinae or with median carina only. Median ocellus usually present, and it'd be at the apex of the frontal carina adjoining the clypeus. Now, one of the things that sometimes helps is six Zeetes, there's a tendency, not all of them, but there's a tendency to have little tiny black dots along the wing veins. You can see a couple examples. We can see these little black dots going along the wing veins. Not all of them have that, and there may be a few in some other things, but in general, if you've got see things with little black spots along the wings, you may need to check some of the other characters, but there's a good chance that you have a six Zeti. So the wings are often hyaline, meaning clear, and ornamented with spots along the veins. They overwinter as nymphs, sometimes under the ground where they feed on roots and grasses. Adults are active jumpers and flyers. Some do come to lights. Now, the next family is the Dictyopharidae. These, and again, there's exceptions. You can see the lower right, lower left-hand corner one doesn't, but a lot of these do have the head expanded out in front of the, out forward. It has these, you know, prolonged out into a snout-like looking structure. I don't know, do you guys remember catching any of these? They occur around here. The ones that look like this one towards the upper right-hand corner, with that snout like structure sticking out. It's kind of a grayish brown in color. So head sometimes or often prolonged in front. Now the frons bears two or three carinae. So that frontal part of the head will have two or three ridges. Again, the second segment of the tarsi still has that row of spines. Now the median ocellus would be absent. So no median ocellus. These usually feed on grasses in wet meadows. This one that I drew an arrow to with that beak going out, that's the genus Scolops.
Is the cephalic horn pretty consistent throughout the family?
That's why I said not all of them do. This one down in the lower left-hand corner really doesn't. So there are some exceptions, but in general, most of the species are prolonged out there. Again, there's some exceptions in some of the other families. You may see that too. So it's not 100%, but if the head's produced out in front like that, there's a good chance you have this family. Again, you may need to check some of the other characters in that. So while I'm here, there's another example, and probably may have been some other places, but again, you can see that nice Y vein in the upper right-hand corner, that towards that anal area of the front wing, two branches come out, and then the single one goes on out. In this same group with the row of spines on the second tibial or second tarsal segment is the fulgoridae itself. I'm not sure if it is a fulgoridae occur up here in North Dakota. There are some in the southern United States, but they're fairly common in the tropics, and they can be quite large and spectacular. The thing to look for in fulgoridae is the anal areas of the wings have lots of cross veins. See, look at the anal area of the hind wings there. Have lots of cross veins. The other families we've talked about do not have that. So these can be quite large in the tropics. One species has a wingspan of 150 millimeters. Again, the anal area of wing is reticulate. Venation. Second tarsal segment still has that row of terminal spines. You may have seen a lot of times when there's a display of insects to show the public, a lot of times they'll have an example of this one at the bottom. It's sometimes called the alligator head because of this, how the head is shaped almost. With the markings of that, it almost does look like an alligator's head from the side. It's also, or I call it, or some people call it a peanut head. It's kind of shaped almost like a peanut. But it's also called a lantern fly. And it was kind of the erroneous belief that that would luminesce. It doesn't really luminesce at all. So, this is, I think I've talked about the O'Briens, the woman that lamented at our ESA meetings about how the group she worked on, the Homoptera, was no longer around. Well, this was the family that she focused on, was the Fulgoridae. Her husband was a weevil person in the beetles, and so they traveled all over the world, all over the place, and would collect everything. They were mainly getting weevils for him and Fulgorids for her, but they collected everything and traded with everybody, and so like if I'd go collecting and caught weevils, they're not really that important to me. I'd send him my weevils and he'd send me what Heteroptera. I was unfortunate that one of my good friends, another stink bug person, got to the O'Briens first, and so he got to trade all the stink bugs with him. So I didn't get very many stink bugs from the O'Briens, but I got a lot of other Heteroptera, including some tinges that Alex is using and some other things that were neat. But anyway, this is the group she worked on, was the Fulgoridae. I got another family here that's not required, the Achillidae. It still has the same tarsal setup as the previous families. And I don't believe this occurs up here. I caught it down in Louisiana. But what's different about them is that the wings overlap out here apically. You can see this goes over here and the other wing goes up underneath it. And that's kind of unusual in the Homoptera. You don't see the wings overlapping like that. So that's one of the characters, how you can tell the Achillidae from the others. But again, it's not a required family, so. Now, we move into several families that have now this other characteristic. You can see in this handout with the flatity, that leg structure in the middle. And again, you got to make sure you're looking at the second tarsal segment. I'll draw in here. This is be like where the tibia coming in. This is segment 1, and this is 2 and 3. But now look, this is what Holly was telling you about. This comes down and it's a little bit more rounded, and there's a spine on each side now. So, and we'll talk about what I think three families in this group. This first one is called the Flatidae. I always thought it was a good name because these are kind of flat vertically. Their wings are roof-like, but they're almost straight up and down. They look like a wedge. So, again, they occur around here. I don't know if you got any or not. They're sometimes yellow, but most of the time they're green in color. And so they do look like just a wedge of a leaf. Again, the second segment of the hind segment now with just the two spines, one on each side. This family has numerous cross veins along the leading margin. See all those cross veins? And even apically, lots of straight parallel veins towards the apex. Also, to me, this one lower right-hand corner is a little bit exceptional. But if you go out this upper margin of the wings, it almost looks like then it's chopped off and truncate. More of that hind margin of the wing. When it's at rest, that hind margin looks more or less straight. Let's see. Also, in a lot of the species, the clavus has a number of little bumps or pustules. And that's what you see, these little dots. Remember, the clavus would be up. It's more along the anal margin of it. But there's these little kind of little pustules up there in that clavicle area. So clavus with numerous small pustule-like tubercles. Most species are green or brown and wedge-shaped, resembling bits of leaves. There's one in Southeast Asia that's more pink in color. And these are, again, feeding on the sap, often on woodier type plants. Now, like I said, you're most apt to confuse that family with the next one, the Acanalineidae, because they're also very wedge-shaped with the wings almost vertical. But now look at the wing vedation. It's more reticulate. You don't have all those parallel veins along that lower margin or the hind margin. And so like I said, it's more reticulate venation around those margins rather than parallel veins like we saw in the flatids. And now the wings, rather than being looking chopped off at the end, they tend to be more rounded. So front wings with reticulate venation held almost vertically at rest. Wings rounded apically rather than rectangular or triangular like we saw in the previous family. Again, the second tarsal segment just has the pair of spines, one on each side. These tend to be more on grasses and herbaceous plants, maybe some woody vegetation. I'm having trouble with my handouts. I got my notebooks too full here, and I can't get them to go back the way they were easily. I'll have to work on that after class. And now, the last family in the Acanarinca we'll talk about is the family Isidae.
Right kind of mix.
The leaf-like legs?
Yeah.
The one on the right up there? Yeah, there's some of these. There was one on an earlier family that had some expanded legs like that too, but these also do.
So those are just leaf-like legs? They aren't like fossorial or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. The Isidae. Front wings are variable in size and shape, but they're often shorter than the abdomen. Usually you see these only in the short-winged forms. This one that's on the top row
second from the left with the white stripe down the back. This is the genus Brucomorpha, which our early studies trapping and collecting on the prairies, we caught lots of these. And I would say, like, out of every 100 specimens, at least 95 or more of them would be short-winged like this, and you'd only get one or two winged, long-winged ones. So the winged ones were much rarer than the short-winged ones. So wings are variable, often shorter than abdomen. If they're longer, they're not usually oval or wedge-shaped like we saw in the Flatidae and the Echinolineidae. These do have the tarsal formula or formation like the Echinolineids and the Flatids, though, with just the pair of spines on that set hind margin of the second segment, one on each side. Often there's one thing you can look for is the hind tibia often has a stout spine. The others have some spines at the apex of the tibia, but usually not as many along the length. But you can see in these that there's often a stout spine in the middle of the tibia up along the length. Again, some species have those leaf-like front legs. There are some that have the head produced out in front of the eyes, almost snout-like, almost like a weevil. We got these commonly on the prairies, and every once in a while we'd get an individual that would have a great big huge expansion on one of the abdominal segments. And we initially thought that it was like strepsipterans, a little strepsipteran parasite that sometimes attacks homopterans. But actually, we kind of, in the same samples, we were getting some little tiny wasps that were wingless wasps, looked almost like little ants. And we kind of figured out what those little wingless wasps were and did a little reading and found out that they also attack these plant hoppers. And so now we decided we didn't have strepsipterans. It was just a little wingless wasp that would attack these things. Okay. Let's... Like I said, my goal was to get through all the Homoptera. We've been going for an hour and a half. Now all we have is the Sternorhynchus. You want to keep going and get it done, or you ready to stop?
I can go either way.
Same.
Well, I'm trying to think how long I think this would take. It'd take only another 15 or 20 minutes probably, because a lot of this, like the scales, I don't require any families of scales. You just, if you can recognize a scale, but they're just too difficult and too hard. There's a couple of families like the Psyllidae and the Alarotidae in that, and then there's only about three or four aphid families. But like I say, my goal is to get through this today, and then Tuesday we have the Socoptera, the Therraptera, the lice, and then the Thysanoptera, so three orders that are smaller. And I was hoping to get through those on Tuesday, and that would be the end of the material for the next exam. And so it's whether we want to go a little longer now and finish this up, or Tuesday do this and then do those three. And I don't know, I probably could get through this and those three families in an hour and a half, so maybe we can just quit there for today and do it Tuesday. So he's got the doctor's appointment, so that's why I was saying, yeah, we had to go longer Tuesday and today and maybe next Tuesday. We're already running behind, but since we're not going to have class tomorrow, I was going to run you a little longer also, or justify running you a little longer here and stuff. So
But that's probably an hour and a half is enough for right now. We can do the Sternarinka beginning on Tuesday of next week, and then tackle those next three orders. Again, there's not a lot in each one of those. The Socoptera, I don't know if we have you know any family, so it's just the order maybe. The Theraptera used to be two orders, the Malophaga and the, now I'm drawing a mind blank, one of those things. But anyway, Anaplura, the Anaplura and the Malophaga. Now they're put together in one big order, the Theraptera. And we may require a family or two in each, but it's the sucking lice and the chewing lice. And so we still kind of separate those two. And then the Thysanoptera, there's two suborders in it, but I'm not sure that we'd have you know the two suborders, but I don't know that we require any families in the Thysanoptera either. So anyway, all right, stop.